We look upon Lewis Carroll with a certain amount of literary awe today, but was that the case when the first Alice appeared?
Well, when the first Alice appeared, we didn't. Lewis Carroll was unknown. It was 1865, and this was a shy, retiring bachelor clergyman, an Oxford Don, who wrote a whimsical story for children that his friends admired so much that he decided to have it published. But the minute it was published, it was very well received, and has been well received for more than 100 years now, so that the popularity of Lewis Carroll began over 100 years ago, but his popularity was such that he was a retiring man and didn't like to be associated with Lewis Carroll. Lewis Carroll is only his pen name. In fact, he was the Reverend Charles Lutwidge Dodson, and for much of his life, he lived a dual life. At Oxford, he was Lewis Carroll, he was Charles Lutwidge Dodson among his colleagues. But yet with the child friends, the young girls, sometimes young boys, that were the center of his life, one of his great pleasures, he was Lewis Carroll. So there are two Lewis Carrolls. This whimsical man, the one who wrote Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass and The Hunting of the Snark, the one who entertained little girls on picnics and photographed children in his rooms, the man who had this is Lewis Carroll. Lewis Carroll, a man who, as Charles Dodson, had a stammer, who, with Lewis Carroll in the company of young girls, did not have a stammer.
So the book was almost an instant hit when it came out.
Well, it revolutionized children's literature. It is a classic in that sense. Up until that time in history, many children's books were didactic, and this particularly poked fun at didacticism. And this is a book that today is so well received. I think it has been for so long because Carroll understood children and he spoke to children on an equal level. He admired them, he respected them. So he told the story. The background of the story is very well known. He went on a boat trip with three young girls, the three daughters of the dean of his church, Christ Church College at Oxford. And he just made up a story as he went along. And then he wrote it down for one of these girls, a very special girl, Alice Little. And from this story, these tales that were just extemporized.
It's okay. This was from the tale that he delivered
again.
Verbally.
Your question, though, children's literature, why it's so important.
So he told
these stories to Alice Little, but he told them from a child's point to a child, understanding. The Victorian culture, the milieu that they came from. He understood, made fun at the nursery rhymes that the Alice and her sisters knew. He made fun at sort of the conventions of Victorian society that Alice would have been comfortable with.
Now, I understand that he illustrated the first book of Alice. What, of course, indelibly, Alice is linked to the illustrations of John Tenniel, but what were the original illustrations by Carroll himself like?
Well, when in the boat trip that took place on July 4th, 1862, and Alice pestered him to write it down for her, and he began revising, and over the next couple of years did in fact write it down, and we have a manuscript called Alice's Adventures Underground, and he tried his own hand at illustrating. He wasn't a trained draftsman, but he had a wonderful and fanciful imagination. And his drawings for the Alice books are kind of wild and grotesque in a way, in some ways frightening, but they're very crude. So when finally his friends advised him that it was worth publishing, it was a delightful book, he knew he would have to get a professional illustrator who could draw more in the conventions of the day and would help sell the book. And he was very fortunate to get John Tenniel, the leading Punch illustrator at the time. And right now, the text and the drawings are indelibly wedded together.
Well, what sort of publishing history did the book have? Did the book have a mass printing when it came out with the original Carroll illustrations?
Well, a very fascinating publishing history. There are two aspects to it. One, as I said, that Dodson wrote, or Lewis Carroll, wrote Alice Adventures Underground, the manuscript, and presented it to Alice Little. And that's a unique copy. And what's very interesting is
that was with the illustrations.
Yes, his own. And that's very interesting because manuscript was sold by Alice Hargraves Little in 1928, came to America, and was returned by the American people to England after the war. And just this week, it has returned to America for the first time since 1948 and is now currently on exhibition at the Morgan Library. But the first commercial printing of Alice has a very interesting history. This is so-called 1865 Alice, which became one of the rarest of rare books. Carroll paid for the printing of his book initially. He was an unpublished author, essentially, and it was pretty common. I mean, Browning paid for his poems. But Carroll was able to get Macmillan, the most reputable publisher of the day, to distribute and handle this. And the book was printed, and Tennille objected to the way the illustrations had been printed. It was a rather flawed printing. And at great personal expense, Carroll was forced to agree, even though by today's standards the flaws are rather minor, and had the entire first edition suppressed. He had sent out about 50 presentation copies. He asked to have those returned, and he received some of those. And he canceled the edition, had it printed again, and that became the first edition. That's 1866. However, 21 of the 1865 Alices do survive, and they are one of the world's rarest and most sought-after books. What's interesting is they had 2,000 sheets left of these flawed books, and he had them decide what to do with them, and in fact, he shipped them to America in bulk, and a publisher in New York, Appleton, bound up these books with a new title page calling it 1866. So in fact, the first printing of Alice came to America and it becomes the first American edition.
Where do you keep your first edition of Alice?
It's stored somewhere back in my imagination. There are only about three or four in private hands now.
What was Carroll's relationship with John Tennille?
Tennille, in fact, thought Carroll overly fastidious and rather difficult to work with, and for the longest time refused to illustrate the sequel through the Looking Glass, and that would have been a great loss, and luckily he was prevailed upon to illustrate through the Looking Glass. The relationship, again, it wasn't Lewis Carroll and John Tennille, it was Reverend Charles Lutwidge Dodson and Tennille, and Dodson was very meticulous and had very clear ideas, and he certainly paid a great deal of attention down to the number of lines that Tennille would use in his drawing. So they seem to have had at least a relationship that was filled with respect, not necessarily the most charming and cordial of relationships, but there was no great fallout. We know that, and through the Looking Glass, Carroll took Tennille's wishes to heart, one, canceling the entire first edition, but also in Through the Looking Glass, when Tennille didn't want to illustrate a wasp in a wig and Carroll dropped an entire chapter from the book. Interestingly, the Tennille illustrations, which now are inconceivable, I mean, they're so fixed in our mind with Alice and all the other wonderful creatures, the Cheshire Cat, the Mad Hatter, the White Rabbit, the Duchess, can go on and on, the Caterpillar. Many of those ideas, the germ of which came from Carroll's original drawings, and he would bombard Tennille. Maybe this was one of the cases, bombard Tennille with information from which to draw ideas, and Tennille didn't need that. And he would also urge him to draw from life, and he would send him pictures and photographs. He was a wonderful photographer, and Tennille didn't need that.
Of course, in reading the book that you edited, Lewis Carroll, A Celebration, I got the impression, in seeing many of the cartoons of Tennille, that many of those cartoons for Alice, or drawings for Alice, were spun off from Punch cartoons.
Well, looking back at early editions of Punch, you can see prototypes of the Alice characters in Punch. Tennille was drawing Alice before there ever was an Alice, and some of the creatures he was drawing, and some of the borders, and etc. He also continued after Alice made his... It's rather curious that Alice made Tennille's fame. He's best known today for the Alice books, and that may perhaps hurt his pride a little bit, because he was very preeminent in his day. The illustrations that he contributed to Punch, we can see his great talent for drawing whimsical creatures, fantastic creatures, animals, and that's appeared both in the Alice books and in Punch.
How do you perceive the Alice books, as simple child stories, or as some people do, very complex books with hidden meanings?
Well, every time you reread the Alice book, it's a different book because you bring your past experience with you to that reading. So the more you read it, the more you take away from it. It's a very rich book. That's by definition why it's a classic and why it's a great book. The more you bring to it, the more it gives back. Certainly the first time through, it's all joy and whimsy and fanciful creatures and funny poems and funny lines and crazy characters. And in fact, it's sort of a mystery or a bizarre. You don't know that Alice is going to wake up. You don't even know she's sleeping the first time through. So the first time it's all fun and entertainment, I think. The next time through, you start seeing, you know how it's going to turn out. You start seeing that it's very carefully constructed, and there's some social satire in it, and there's a lot of relentless logic, perhaps absurd, I think is the best genre. Carroll took logic and pushed it to the extreme, where it no longer makes sense. So that, rather than being nonsense, it makes too much sense, which makes it absurd. And I think one keeps going back, and every time one goes back, one sees a little bit more. And it's amazing, too, that here we are more than 100 years after the two Alice books were published, and the Alice books don't change, but our world changes and our view changes. So they were read at the time as delightful children's stories, perhaps, but they've always appealed to adults. And today, we adults rather like them for their characters, but also for their language. They're filled with quotations. The Alice books have been one called the most inexhaustible tale in the world, and often are cited as the most frequently quoted or misquoted books in the world. It seems that all of Carroll's insights are even more appropriate today. He was ahead of his time, it seems.
Dodgson was a mathematician. How did he rank as a mathematician?
Well, I think if he had never written the Alice books, he would rank much lower today than if he had not written the Alice books. His photography is an area where he ranks very high, and whether he had written Alice or not, he would still be known today as the most outstanding children's photographer of the 19th century. He was also an outstanding letter writer, and his letters are a joy. It's filled with, on one hand, Dodgson, and the other, Lewis Carroll. They read just like the Alice books. It's kind of an Alice in Wonderland without an Alice. But he was a very fine mathematician. He was an Oxford Don. He was very brilliant. His genius took many forms in mathematics, and sometimes very quirky. And on one end, he worked consistently on logic, symbolic logic, and has written a number of textbooks filled with Lewis Carroll examples that are quoted and quoted and quoted again today, and all works on logic. On the other hand, he did some work in rather quirky areas, calculating scores in tennis tournaments or method ranking by inversion for parliamentary elections. And in some of these odd pamphlets that he published, the mathematicians today have found that he was years ahead of his time, so that rather than being just another competent Victorian mathematician, he was rather clever, and certainly he was working along an old tradition, and today he's not remembered for great insights, but he was a fine mathematician.
It seems to me that in recent years some rather sinister insinuations have been made with regard to Lewis Carroll and his photography of young girls, especially the nude photography. What's the story behind that?
That's the big question. It's always been so. We know a lot more today than we've ever known before. Certainly people like Joyce, who called Carroll Lewd Carroll, and Nabokov, who called Carroll Lewis Carroll Carroll because he was the first Humbert, expressed one rather prevalent opinion on Carroll. But that's a 20th century post-Freudian view of the man. In his time, he loved children. There was great entertainment. He would retire from society because it took too much time away from his duties at Oxford and his religious work. But he would never give up the little girls, the entertainments. And one of the things he liked to do was draw little girls and photograph them. And he did a lot of photographs of children in costumes. And after a while, he photographed them in the nude. Now,
in the Victorian era.
Yes, but remember, in the Victorian era, the notion of children and of nudity were different. A child was the closest thing to God, full of innocence and purity. And Dodson respected children. He loved them, there's no question. And he was very respectful of their wishes. He always had parents' permission. There were usually witnesses at these sessions, and the parents came or someone, the nursemaid came along. So there was no impropriety at the time. And certainly there's no doubt that he had a clear conscience at the time. And there's no doubt that in his nude photographs, as well as all photographs, he was pursuing art. Now, a couple of more, we need to think of a few other perspectives on this. One is the 20th century. He may have been innocent, but we're not so innocent. So we said, well, why did he do this? We know that when he died, he left instructions in his will that all the nude photographs and their negatives should be destroyed so they don't fall into improper hands, or that they should be returned to the families. So for quite a long time, we had no notion of what these nude photographs were like. Recently, a few have turned up, kept in the families, and they're kind of unusual ones in that they're photographs that have been painted over in color and new backgrounds, and they become almost in a narrative painting tradition. And they're certainly, from the casual eye, a lot less erotic than one would imagine. And one can see him in all innocence working on these photographs. On the other hand, there are a lot of photographs of young girls in nightgowns with bare breasts or bare legs and bare feet lying on couches and that sort of thing that recur. And those are the areas that we in the 20th century say, well, what was going on in that subconscious? Certainly not in the conscious, but in the subconscious.
Who was Ellen Terry, and what was her relationship with Lewis Carroll?
Ellen Terry was the foremost actress of her day, and Lewis Carroll loved the theater, and Lewis Carroll loved celebrities. He has long relationships with many Victorian celebrities, Tennyson being one, the Rossettis, the Pre-Raphaelites being another. And curious or incurious, or to borrow his phrase, Ellen Terry was one of his lifelong friends, this beautiful woman of the stage. And the Victorian clergyman. In fact, for the high churchman, theater itself was suspect, but not for Carroll. Well, that was one place where he broke with his father and broke with some of his friends and religiously went to the theater and developed a warm relationship with Ellen Terry. They corresponded and visited, and he the train, of course, arrived in Oxford in the mid-century, so he was able to get down to London stage quite easily, and he would take his little girlfriends on tours to the theater in the afternoon, and he would implore Ellen Terry to get him seats, and he would see her behind. He knew the family. He had photographed the family, photographed Ellen Terry, and it's one of the cases where he had a lifelong relationship with a grown-up woman. He had many relationships with the children's mothers, and he had many sisters, so he just didn't like little girls only. But Ellen Terry was able to help him, in fact, start several working-class girls on careers in the theater.
One last question. Carroll wrote some lesser-known books, including The Hunting of the Snark and the Sylvie and Bruno books. What were those books like, and did they have any similarity to Alice in Wonderland?
Well, the Sylvie and Bruno books are considered the third of Carroll's three masterpieces after Alice. It's, in fact, my favorite work. It's a short poem, a long poem comparatively, a short book compared to the Alice's, and it's been called An Alice in Wonderland Without an Alice. And that's filled with nonsense. It's about a crew who goes on this impossible voyage in search of a snark. And it's one of the poems that the moderns find so compelling, because there's, on one hand, this compelling quest venture and lots of nonsense. On the other, it's a kind of a lurking terror in that poem, and almost an existential poem. The Sylvie and Bruno books, by contrast, are about 800 pages longer than The Hunting of the Snark, which is about 16 pages long. And the Sylvie and Bruno books are his last work, these are two volumes published 1889-1893. He died in 1898, where it's a fairy story that has a lot of the Alice's in it, but it also has a lot of Victorian moral dilemma and preaching and notions of society. There are kind of two books in there. One is Dodson in his old age preaching to children about piety and goodness and love. And the other hand, you have Lewis Carroll with these fanciful characters and their involvement. So it's not been as well accepted as the others, yet for the person who loves Lewis Carroll, there's plenty in those two books.
One last question.
Okay.
What was it like for you when you first read Alice in Wonderland?
I think everyone who's read Alice has story after story. I can say two things. One is that I was frightened by it, and I've learned since that's a fairly common experience. Martin Gardner has said the same thing. It does frighten some children, and that's why today it's largely an adult book for some people. The second point I can make about it is that I got to know Alice like a lot of people got to know Alice in our generation, and that's through the popular culture. Alice in Wonderland is everywhere. It's in plays, it's in film, it's on TV specials, it's on belt buckles, it's on T-shirts, it's on an industry of books, so that without ever having read Alice in Wonderland, you can be thoroughly familiar with all the characters and all the quotations, so that I grew up knowing Alice in Wonderland without ever having formally sat through reading it in other than abridged versions.
You never read the full version of Alice in Wonderland as a child?
Well, what I'm saying is I don't remember that as my initial. I'm sure I read it or it was read to me. I know I read the Nursery Alice, which was a version for children, but I was thoroughly familiar with the book when I finally, as an adult, came back to it.
It took being an adult to have the proper perspective and appreciation of the
proper
book.
I don't like the word proper, because one has a different perspective. I once approached it as a child, and I didn't have a rich experience, but as an adult, I've had a very rich experience. I look forward to more experiences.
Thank you.
Thank you.